Okay, so we are holding on Nunhe Omadeh's a little bit past the middle of the wide lines, lined against Tirashta. About 20 lines or so from the bottom. We learned yesterday that even though the Pasuk says and makes it sound like Reuven actually had relations with Bilhah, which would be a serious avera, but we said that actually, according to many opinions, he didn't do that. We started saying Kol Aimer Reuven Chata Ein Elataya. We actually brought a number of opinions of Tanoim on the subject of whether he actually did it, and then of course did Tshuva later on. We know that Reuven is a symbol of Tshuva, or is it that he never did it in the first place? He was going to do it, or he just moved Yaakov's bed, etc. So now we're going to have similar things about various other figures in Jewish history where the Pasuk makes it sound as though they committed serious avodas, and in fact it's not like that. So starting with a simon, Reuven bnei Eli bnei Shmuel David Shlomo the Yoyosh simon. These are all the various people that were in Yoyosh is a mistake, actually. It's supposed to be Yoshiyahu. So from here until the end of the paragraph, we're going to be dealing one by one with these great figures of Jewish history and see what they actually did and what they didn't do. So the first one is Bnei Eli. Omer of Shmuel Benachmeni, Omer of Yonatan. Kola Omer Bnei Eli, Chotu Eina El Choyah. Anybody who thinks that the sons of Eli did and the Averis that are attributed to them in the process is making a mistake. Now, you have like this. There's two different, in the Pesukim there, it describes like this. You have Bnei Eli, it says, were treating the Karbanas and the people who brought them very disrespectfully. The Pesukim describe how people would come and bring Karbanas, and these Bnei Eli, Chofni and Pinchas were their names, would be demanding extra portions of the Karbanas, more than what they were entitled to, and they'd be demanding them and taking them even before the chalev was offered on the Mizbeach. So that the Gemara doesn't have a problem with saying that they were doing. Okay, it's a very serious avera, but it's not, the Pasuk says so explicitly, so fine. But the Pasuk also mentions a few psukim later that Eli heard what's going on, and he also heard Asher Yishkavu Nefanoshim Atzoivos, that they were lying together with the women who come to gather by the Ohel Moed. Now, that's a pretty serious avera. So that's what the Gemara is going to be focusing on, that in fact, if we think they actually did that, that they actually had relations with these women who come to the Bais Mikdash to offer Karbanos, then you're making a mistake. Why? Shenema, because at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, it says, V'shom shnei b'nei Eli, imaron b'risa elikim, is not part of the Pasuk over there. Apparently the Gemara is kind of combining together two different psukim. Anyway, chofni u'pinchas koinim la'ashem. It's at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, it's about Torah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah. It says that Elkanah and his family would come up to the Mishkan, would come up to the Mishkan regularly, and there were the two sons of Eli, Chofni and Pinchas, who were koinim for Hashem. Now, that process is extra. It doesn't belong in that context. What does it have to do with that Elkanah and his family are coming there to the Mishkan, and Chofni and Pinchas are there? The point is, if it says Chofni and Pinchas, it means that it wants to put them together. It wants to say that Chofni and Pinchas are on a similar level. So therefore, Sava like a Rav, so Rav Shmuel and Achmeni and Rav Yonatan holds like Rav, Sha'amar Rav, Pinchas loy Chata, that, as we're going to see soon in the Gemara is going to prove that at least Pinchas did not do this kind of Avera, of being Mizana with an Eshet Ish, and therefore, Ma Pinchas loy Chata, Av Chofni loy Chata. So if the Pasuk is putting them together unnecessarily and saying that Chofni and Pinchas were the koinim of Hashem at that time, then it comes to tell us, just like we can prove from the Pesukim, as we're going to do soon, that Pinchas didn't do wrong as far as the Issur of Eshet Ish, so also we're going to say neither did Chofni. So what does the Pasuk mean when it says that they would lie together with the women who came to the Mishkan to bring Karbanos? It's like this. Because they delayed bringing the Karbanos of birds of these women. We know that a woman at various times has to bring a Karban of birds, in particular after she gives birth. And a person is supposed to stick around until their Karban is offered. Now, since we see from the Pesukim earlier that Chofni and Pinchas were being disrespectful about the Karbanos, and they were demanding extra portions and so forth, so that means when women came to bring carbonus of birds, which after all are small carbonus, then they wouldn't be in such a rush to bring them. They would say, you know, those we'll deal with afterwards. First we want to deal with the big important carbonus, the ones that we're going to get a lot of meat out of or whatever, and then, you know, we'll get around to your little bird carbon sometime, some other time. So the result is, therefore, that these women have to stay overnight in the Beis Mikdash, but near it. So the point is, therefore, because of that, the prophet considers it as if they had relations with these women. Because again, like we said yesterday about Reuben, he interfered with the Yaakov's marital life by getting involved in the matter of Bilhah, and therefore the prophet considers it as though he interfered on a gross level by having relations with her in the same way over here. Hophni and Pinchas interfered with these women's relationship with her husband, and therefore counted on the standards of the pasuk, on Hashem's standards, as if they actually had relations with them, but not that they actually did. Some of the mafreshim on the pasuk also point out if these women had to stay overnight, what would often happen is, so you'd have, I mean, there are men also who come to this mikdash to bring karbanos and are staying overnight for one reason or another. So the result is that you had a mixing of men and women that there shouldn't be, that they're staying over. Maybe some of them are sleeping a little closer to each other than they should be, and therefore the prophet blames Hophni and Pinchas for that because they're the ones who made that situation happen.
Did they have any mikdash, a place where the women waited and the place where the men waited? It wasn't the same place.
Well, I mean,
Nashim is this.
Well, yeah, I mean, but well, the Ezra's Nashim. Keep in mind, first of all, the Mishkan didn't have an Ezra's Nashim. That's that you have in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan, you just had the Azara. But second of all, we're not talking about that they're actually staying there in the Mishkan overnight. We're talking about they would stay someplace nearby. Somebody in Shiloh would put them up, whatever. But still, you have.
I just happened to have this Mishkan, not in time of the Mishkan.
This was in the time of the Mishkan in Shiloh.
Oh, still early, okay.
Mishkan stood in Shiloh for 369 years. And this is the Hophni and Pinchas were this whole story at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel takes place in Shiloh. Uri, after that, you have Hashem sends Nevi'im to warn that as a result of this, Mishkan Shiloh is going to be destroyed, which it was, and then eventually the Beis Mikdash was eventually many years later the Beis Mikdash was built. But this is all while the Mishkan is standing in Shiloh.
This warning that came to Avi, did that change his actions?
So what happened was, we're not saying that Avi himself did something wrong, but Avi finds out what's going on. He hears what's going on, and the prophet says that he went and told his children, as we're going to quote a prophet from it soon, that you're doing something wrong, but they didn't listen.
Oh.
Okay, so we're saying again that Hophni and Pinchas, they didn't actually lie with these women, but they did delay bringing their korbanos, and therefore the prophet is counting as if they actually lay with them. So, Gufa, getting back to, we said that Rav had said that among these two guys, Hophni and Pinchas, that Pinchas definitely did not do this avera, and therefore we said that Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni holds that also we can say that Pinchas didn't either. So let's get back to that. Amar Rav Pinchas leichata. We can prove that Pinchas did not do that avera of having relations with an Eshet Ish. Shenema, because you have later on in Sefer Shmuel, it tells like this: during one of Shaul's wars against the Plishtim, the pasuk sets the scene. Va'achia ben Achitov, Achi Ichobed ben Pinchas ben Eli Kohen Hashem. That over there, you have the Kohen Gadol who was wearing the Urim Metumim, was Achia, the son of Achitov, where Achitov is the brother of Ichobed. Ichobed is the son of Pinchas, the son of Eli, and he was a Kohen. So in short, in other words, Achia was the grandson of Pinchas. And at the time of that story, the Shaul, this Achia was serving as Kohen Gadol. This is the Pashtus, the same as Achimelech that we have later that was in the Mishkan of Noi, where he's the one who gave David food and Doeg said Lashon Hara about them. Anyway, the point is that he's descended from Pinchas. So Rav says, how could it be that Pinchas could have done such a serious avera as being the zana with an Eshet Ish, and later on the prophet is going to mention, is going to say how his descendant was the Kohen Gadol? We have a prophet that says about a person who is mizana, Hashem will cut off from a person who does such a thing, literally means somebody who's awake. Oina, somebody who answers. Me'ola Yaakov, from the tents of Yaakov. Umagish mincha l'Hashem tzvachos, and somebody who brings korbanos to Hashem. So somebody who's mezana with an eishes ish does not deserve to have the heir of oina or the magish mincha among his descendants. Meaning, im Yisrael, if a person who does such an aveira is Yisrael, where anyway his descendants are not bringing korbanos because they're zorim, then it means then it means his punishment will be that he will not have children or descendants who will be heir, who will be sharp among the chachamim, or he won't have a descendant who among the talmidim is sharp enough to be able to answer questions in the Beit Medrash. The in koyin hu, and if he's a koyin, then he won't have descendants who bring korbanos to Hashem. That will be his punishment, that his descendants will not have that privilege. So if we see that Pinchas, his descendant, that Pinchas' grandson, did have that privilege of being the Kohen Gadol and bringing Korbanos, then it shows that at least Pinchas did not do that aveira. So you see from that Pinchas did not do the aveira of being mezana with an eshes ish. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily, according to Rav, that Chofni didn't. It could be that Rav might say that Chofni did, but Pinchas did not, as the Gemara is going to say soon. But at least as far as Pinchas, it's clear that he didn't do it, based on that, since the Pasuk tells us that his grandson was Kohen Gadol. And therefore, now, Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni before takes that further and says, given the heckish that we had between Chofni and Pinchas, which otherwise wasn't necessary, then it demonstrates that actually neither did Chofni do anything wrong, because the Pasuk compares him to Pinchas, who is clear from this Pasuk, didn't do that. So the Gemara says, Ela haksiv asher yishkuvun, but the Pasuk says that they, in plural, lay with these women. So we see that both Chofni and Pinchas were involved. The answer is yishkuvan ksiv. The answer is yes, but the Pasuk is written without the vav after the vay. So therefore we can read it as if it said yishkuvan, yishkuvain, or whatever, which means that he, in the singular, slept with them. So therefore, according to that, again, we would say that only one of them did it, namely Chofni, again, because we have a proof that Pinchas didn't, based on what we said of his grandson being Kohen Gadol. So we would say that that's the Pasuk is saying that Eli heard that one of them is doing it, and he goes and calls them both together and tells them you're doing wrong. But not that actually both of them had done that. So the question is, but the prophet continued that once Eli found out, he said, Al bonnoi, know my children, in the plural, kilo tovashmur, because this news that I'm hearing, this that I'm hearing from the people of what you're doing is wrong. You're not supposed to be doing that. Now, we did say before that they were both guilty of disrespecting the korban. So Marsha says, so in that case, who says that, why is the Gemara asking, and it's going to answer, that it still means that only one of them did the Aveda with the women? Maybe it means both of them are doing the Aveda with the Korbanos. So Marsha says, because right before that, the prophet mentioned about this thing with the women, therefore the implication is that when he's calling them together and talking to them about it, then he's talking about the Aveda with the women, not about the Aveda with the Korbanos. Anyway, so the question is that since he says, Al bonnoi, know my children, in the plural, that seems to imply both of them are guilty of it. And again, the answer is, Amar of Nachmi Gniksiv. Same thing as we said with Yishkuvun, that since it said the word me and bonai are both spelt the same way, in singular and in plural, it's only the Nakodas are different, we can read the Pasuk as if it said, Bni, my son, so therefore he's only talking to one of it. So he's primarily only talking to one of his sons, namely Chosni. But not Pinchas, as we said. Okay? The question is, what about, though, the Pasuk continues, that Ma'avirim Am Hashem, which one meaning of Ma'avirim is that you're causing the Jewish people to do Averis. And again, Omer of Hunabredir Rishu Ma'avirim Ksiv. Again, you have, it's written in the Pasuk without the Yud, and therefore it can be read as Ma'avirim, that one person is causing them to transgress these Averis, but not two of them. Now here you have a bit of an issue. Rashi says, I can't understand how you have the name of the Chacham over here, it must be a tremendous mistake. Now, what is Rashi's problem with it? A couple of things. So some of the Mefarshim say, as far as the name of the Chacham, Rashi may have had the Girsa over here, not Rav Huna Breidi Rav Yeshua, but Rav Breidi Rav Yeshua. And in that case, we don't find any such Chacham. But the Chacham Tzvi says, never mind that. Rashi's question is, Rashi goes on to say, that if we look in accurate copies of Tanakh, we have this nowadays also, we will find the word Ma'avirim is in fact spelled with the Yud at the end. So what is the Gemara saying? It's spelled without it. In any case, Rashi says, that's not, the word Ma'avirim in the passage doesn't mean they're causing the Jewish people to transgress Avedis. It means that the Jewish people are circulating around, the Meloshin Bayaviru, Kurvamachna, they're circulating around these statements about what you boys are doing. So in that case, so who cares whether it's in singular or plural, talking about the Jewish people collectively. So for all those reasons, Rashi says, we can't be good at this. Another point of Rashi's may be, okay, we have sometimes somebody wrote something mistakenly on the margin of the Gemara and it wound up in the Gemara. We have such things all over Shas. But that you should have a name of a Chacham attached to it. How on earth did the name of Rabbi Yeshua, of Rav Huna, Rabbi Yeshua, get attached to something like that was written on the margin of somebody's Gemara? Anyway, so Rashi takes the whole thing out. Tosfos, on the other hand, says that no, all it is we have the Jews stand in front of us in the Gemara. That the Gemara asked the question, and Rav Huna Breid Yerushua gave the answer. Evidently, Tosfos says the Gemara, the Chachamim of the Gemara, had a different Nesoda than we do. And in fact, Tosfos brings another example of such a thing from a Yerushalmi that seems to imply that they had a different Nesoda. There was actually a different word. Here was just a different spelling of a word. There it seems to be. So it was Tosfos saying that Yerushalmi actually had a different word in one place in Tanakh. And you have a huge amount, if you look at Julian Ashaf on the side, you have one of the probably the longest Julian Ashafs from Rebbe Akiva Eger in all of Shaf. You have on the side of it here, where he brings dozens of places from all over Tanakh and Midrashim, where we see, at least on the face of it, that exactly that. There are definitely, there do seem to be pretty clearly places where the Gemara or the Medrash has a different Masoda about the spelling of a word in Tanakh than we do. Sometimes even the Gemara, it has implications in Halacha. Sometimes the Gemara will darshan from the form of a word, whether it's Mole or Chaser, will darshan a certain din, and we, if we look in our Tanakh, in our handwritten and printed Tanakh, we won't find that. In fact, in many places, we'll find the Masoda explicitly says not like that. So what is it? So one way of looking at it is, okay, you know, we have the Gemara mentions in other places that we're not expert in chaseiros yeseiros. We're not expert in which words are in Chumash and in Tanakh are supposed to be written full with an extra vav or yud and which one's not. So, okay, the Gemara has one Masorah. We have a different one. You actually find in many places in the Sfarim of the Masorah, you have places where it mentions that the Ma'avoi, the people of the West, meaning Eretz Yisrael, have one Girsa, have one Masoda, and the Magid Choy, the Easterners, meaning the ones from Babel, have a slightly different one. In general, in matters of Masoda, we usually follow the Ma'avoi, whereas the Gemara was written in Babel, which is Magid Choy. So therefore, you could have, that would be a reason, that could be a possible reason why you have difference. So in here, according to that, then, the Gemara would be saying that in their Tanakh, they, in their copies of Sefer Shmuel, they had the word Ma'avirim written without the Yud, whereas we have it with. Okay, it's a difference. It's a different Masorah. Okay, the Yad Malachi wants to say on it like this. At least the Gemara, the Tosfos is saying that you actually have, based on a Gemara, based on Yerushalmi, it seems there's actually a place where they had a different word in Tanakh. We're in one place where it says 20, that Shimshon judged the Jewish people for 20 years, and the Yerushalmi says for 40, and the Yerushalmi quotes 40, and Tosfos says that shows the Yerushalmi had a different word. The Yad Malachi, one of the Udi Yerush Achronim, says no. Of course you can't say that they had a different word. No, the words of Tanakh are accurate. What it means is the Yerushalmi doushens the process because it says 20, twice over there, and therefore the Yerushalmi doushens it as 40. But anyway, so basically, though, you have this concept. I mean, you have various Sfarim that try to reconcile these things and say that maybe, in fact, the Gemara didn't have the Masorah, that maybe actually the Gemara did have the same Masorah as ours, but the more straightforward way to understand it is, as Tosfos is saying, and as Rabbi Akiva Eger is saying, that yes, in fact, you do have places where the Masorah of the Gemara differs from our Masorah. Okay. So, What about Vaksiv Bnei Blial? But the pasuk finishes off, not finishes off, Udiyu in the Pesukim, it says that the children, that Eli's children were Bnei Blial, children of wickedness in the plural, and there there's no way to understand that it means only one of them, because Bnei Blial clearly means sons in the plural. And again, Marshall says it can't just be talking about what they did with the Korbanos, because that wouldn't be a serious enough avera to warrant the name Bnei Blial. Bnei Blial you use for things involving, you find in other places where Bnei Blial is used about people who are committing znus, and maybe other very, maybe also very other serious avedas, like avodah zara. You don't find that it should be used about something like this, where they treated the korbanos disrespectfully. So then, in that case, it means both of them are guilty. And the answer is b'toch shahola the pin the pinchas limchot b'chafni v'loy micha. As we said yesterday, you have when a person is able to be moicha on somebody else who's doing an avera and he doesn't, then he's held responsible because Pinchas could have been moicha in chafni and tell him not to do this and he didn't. Malal b'chasa kila chasa. Therefore, the pasuk considers it as if he himself did the avera, even though he did not. So again, it comes out then, according to Rav, according to this whole explanation that we just said, Chofni, in fact, was guilty of the Avera in straightforward sense of being Mazana with these women. Pinchas was not, as we see that his grandson had the privilege of being Kohen Gadol and bringing Korbanos, whereas according to Rav Shmuel Ben Achmeni, neither one of them did, and it's only that they were disrespectful of the Korbanos. Okay, another one. Omer of Shmuel Ben Achmeni, Omer of Yenison. Now let's go on to the next generation. You have the pasuk described how Shmuel had been the judge of the Jewish people. Then it says when he got old, as we're going to quote now, so the pasuk mentions that he had his children, that his children were taking over as judges when Shmuel was getting old. But the pasuk says on them, that they were doing wrongly. They inclined after monetary gain. They took bribes, and they perverted justice. So on the surface, you would understand that to mean exactly that, that they were dishonest judges and they were taking bribes. So the Rishon Chaim is telling us that you're making a mistake if you think that. Again, the Gemara is sort of paraphrasing the pasuk, the actual wording in the pasuk is Kasher Zok and Shmuel V'loy Holchu Bonav V'drachav. Anyway, implying V'drachav Hu D'loy Holchu. Now, if it literally means that they were so low that they were corrupt judges, then it wouldn't have to say they didn't go in Shmuel's ways. Obviously, then you don't even need to mention that. And there's no question if they're acting like that, they're not acting in the Shmuel's ways. So it means v'drachav hu d'loy holchu means they're not acting in the exact ways that Shmuel did, but michta nami leichotu, but they didn't actually do such serious averus either as the pasuk is attributing to them. So what does the pasuk mean then when it says that they inclined that they inclined after monetary gain? Means also means they didn't do like what their father did, which is what did their father do? Shmuel during the whole time when he was shofet would circulate around, he would travel around among all the places of the Jewish people, the Don Oysam Ba'orehem, and he would judge them in their cities. So he wouldn't wait for the people to come to him. He wouldn't wait for the people to come to him. He would go to them. Shenema, as the pasuk says, V'holach Midei Shana B'Shana, as the pasuk says that Shmuel would go around every year, the Saba Beisel V'Agyogol V'Amitzvah, he would travel around to Beisel and Gilgal and Mitzvah, which are various places in Eretz Yisrael, the Shafat of Yisrael, and he would judge the Jewish people, and then he would return home eventually.
It also says the Sham Beitel.
That's true. Also, and the Gemara mentions in Brachas that also Shmuel would take along his whole household with him, meaning he didn't want to have enough from anybody else on the way, so he would take along everything that he needed. He would take along a mobile home or something, and this way he doesn't have to have hanah from anybody on the way. Right.
How can you say Vahiki Zarken Shmuel? He was 52 years old.
Well, okay, this is a cost to all of. He became prematurely old because of all the hard work he did for the Jewish people. But, anyway, the point is That's the so the point is, the Shmuel traveled around everywhere in order to teach the people, in order to teach and judge the people. The Heimloi also came. Now Shmuel's sons did not do that. Ella, Yoshu Ba'arehem, they stayed in their city. The pasuk says they were in the city of Be'er Sheva. In order to increase the pay of their chazanim, meaning shamashim, and their soifrim. In other words, what happens is that, like this, when if they had to go around, then it means these chazanim and soifrim would also have to go along with them. So therefore, and Marsha says, so they figured, you know what, these guys are going to end up spending a lot of money on that. Travel is expensive. So therefore, so like this, let them better stay home. Let's all stay over here, and the people will come to us. And also, Marsha adds, what the Gemara means over here is that they were using the excuse also, we have things to take care of in the city over here, therefore you need to come to us. And we don't have any free time to travel around. We don't have any free time to travel around to you. So what happened was that they're paying them extra for their pay. So Shmuel's sons are demanding extra pay. When a person is judging, a dayan is not really allowed to be paid for his expertise in dayanus. What he's allowed to be paid for is for his time, because otherwise, like this, if he wasn't same way as the teaching Torah, if he weren't judging, he could be having some other job, and therefore instead he's not, so he's entitled to get paid for that. It's called Chai Batala, but they're taking more than they're supposed to, and therefore Marsha says what happens is these Shamashim and Chazanim end up actually. So they're demanding that the people pay fees for Dinei Torah, and it happens, therefore, that they're called, they're making one person pay more than another, and therefore that causes justice to be perverted. So it's not that they themselves literally took bribes, but the way they had the situation set up, it made it more possible for there to be corruption among the Chazanim and the Sofim. And that things are not getting judged as fairly as they should. And like this also, they're causing that all the Jewish people have to schlep to them.
I'm sorry. Isn't this the same thing as the Bnei Eli, that he kept men and women apart from each other? The men had to come to have the din Torah. They had to leave their families.
True, I guess. But that's true. The Gemara is not mentioning that point. It's a good point. Why not? But I mean, the fact that men are usually the ones involved in din Torah. And the fact that men have to be, the fact that men regularly travel away from home from work anyway, so maybe it wasn't as big a deal. The women, on the other hand, where they just brought their korban and now they have to hurry home. They brought their korban, now they're tahor. Then the pasuk is blaming them for keeping the women extra. So over here, I guess the idea is once they actually came to town, then fine, they do the din Torah quickly. But the point is the fact that they made them schlep out there. But again, the point is more that the Gemara is focusing more on the fact that they were doing it in order that their chazanim, in order that their shamashim and their sofrim get more money, and that was causing inappropriate perversions of justice. Because again, some people are paying more, some people are paying less, Ketanoi. So the Gemara says actually there's a machlokes tanoim. What exactly the sons of Shmuel did? There's other opinions. When it says vayitu achrei habosa, it says they inclined after monetary gain. Reb Meir and Chelkam Shalom b'fiem. Reb Meir says it means that they asked verbally for their portion of Meiser. Now Shmuel himself and his sons were Levim, so therefore they're entitled to Meiserishin. But the Levi, first of all, is not supposed to be asking for the Meiser. It's supposed to be you give it to him voluntarily. So it's not appropriate for them to ask. So they were doing that. Second of all, what happened was when they're asking, they're, after all, they're the leaders, they're the judges. So therefore, people are going to give them their Meiser. And therefore, it means other poor Levim are losing out and not getting Meiser where they could have instead gotten it. So therefore, so the mayor is also saying they didn't actually pervert justice, but they did wrong by causing that poor Levim are not getting ma'aser that they could have gotten. Rabbi Yehuda, I mean, the lie he tilo abal abasim. Rabbi Yehuda says a different explanation. What it was is they had money for investment, which they imposed that on balabasim. They would give. That's a very common thing when a person has money to invest. They make what's called an iska, which is that you're the venture capitalist. You give money or you lend money or whatever to somebody who's going to use it to run a business, and then you split the profits according to some formula. You have a whole concept called a heter iska because you have to be careful with that because there are genuine ribbis involved. In any case, what happened was that they were doing that. The problem is that therefore that makes them more likely to favor those balabasim in a din Torah because they have an interest in it now because if that balabas wins his case, it means that their investments are doing better. So therefore, when such balabasim would come to dinei Torah, then they would judge in their favor. So it comes out according to Rabbi Yehuda, so Rabbi Yehuda would disagree with what we said before, that they didn't actually pervert justice. According to Rabbi Yehuda, they did, because they're actually judging these people favorably where they weren't supposed to do that. Rabbi Akiva says they took an extra portion of Meiser. Meiser is supposed to be 10%. They were demanding more than that. So they were demanding more than that, and that amount to stealing. Marshall learned differently. It's not that they're taking extra Meiser. What it means is similar to what we said before about Chelkum Shalom B'M is. They say to a balabas, look, you have this meiser. You're supposed to be giving it to a levy, whichever levy you want. So like this, we're gonna grab it. We're gonna grab it. Not even like Reb Meir that they would ask for it, but rather Reb Yossi is saying that Reb Akiva rather is saying they would actually grab it. So according to him, again, they're not actually judging. Perverted justice when they're sitting in a din Torah, but they are taking from and Marsha is saying not even that they're stealing, because after all the Meiser does belong to the Levim, but they're taking it inappropriately. And Rabbi Yossi Eva Matonis not the Bizraya. Rabbi Yossi says a fourth possibility that what it means is they grab the Matonis, the Zroya Lachayim Bekeva, which are actually supposed to be going to the Kohenim. So again, one meaning would be that it means actual gezel, that they're actually stealing something that's supposed to belong to the Kohenim. Marsha says that the Gemara mentions in Chulin that there's a suffix whether Levim have to give these matanos or not. When the pasuk says they have to give min ha'am, does that include the Levim as well? So therefore, what it means is that they're grabbing it, taking the view that's not meant to come from Levim either. So in any case, you have different opinions over here again. Did they actually judge wrongly, or is it just that they did these various things that are not appropriate for a person, especially for a dayan, to do?
When they took extra meiser, isn't that gezel, or is it also a problem of that the tvor is mekukal because of the too much meiser was taken?
Ah, so that's not Tosfos. Marsha points that out, that Rashi is saying they took more than the 10% they were supposed to, but if you're going to say they do that, then it comes out they're eating tevil. And we're not saying, the pasuk's not mentioning that they ate tevil, so how does that work? So therefore, that's why he says that it means that they're not taking more meiser, but they're taking the meiser that was supposed to be for any levy who would come, and they're grabbing the whole thing. But not that they're taking more than the 10%.
If you take more than 10%, it's considered tevel.
Well, because the problem is, keep in mind, after Meiser Sheni, there's another Meiser still. That after Meiser Rishon, there's still another Meiser, right? Meiser Sheni some years, Meiser Oni some years, until all the Meisers have been taken out. Yeah, it's tevel. So if let's say for example, if Meiser Rishon is supposed to be 10%. And instead you're taking, let's say, 15%, then it comes out a third of what you took, is not going to have Meiser Oni or Meiser Sheni separated on it. So therefore, it would be tevel. I mean, I guess Rashi could answer that. Okay, what they would do is after they would take it, they would take out the Maisa Sheni or Maisa Oni themselves. But I guess Marashah doesn't like that idea because otherwise the Gemara should have had to mention that, and therefore he explains that it just means they grabbed the existing Maisa, but not that they took more than they were supposed to. Omer of Shmuel ben Achmeni, Omer of Yenison. Kola Omer David Chata in Elatoya. Anybody who says that David sinned in the matter of Bathsheba is making a mistake. Now, we know the story in brief that David took Bathsheba and lay with her. Then she found out she's pregnant, and he called back Uriah. And to make a long story short, he ends up executing Uriah. He doesn't end up executing Uriah, but he sends him back to the battle in a way that he should get killed. He ends up getting killed, and David marries Bathsheba. So what we're saying is that if you think that David actually had relations with Bathsheba while she was an Eish HaFish, you're making a mistake. Shenema, because you find earlier the pasuk describes David by he David l'chadrocha machil v'ashem imay v'gemer. Everything that David did was successful, and Hashem was with him. How is it possible that he would do an avera like that, and the Shechina would be with him? Now, this pasuk is describing David many years earlier, but Hashem imay means that Hashem is always with him. And therefore, so Hashem would have protected him from doing. We know that Hashem helps the tzaddik to not do serious averus. So if you had Hashem imoy, then Hashem would have then that protection that itself would have protected him from doing such a serious averus.
Maybe you could say that Hashem is miyachad his name on a person only when he knows that his person is not going to sin.
That too, yeah. But that would be if it said like K David. So later on in Tanakh, you find that a K David Avicha, but that's after David had passed away. Yeah, usually you have, while a tzaddik is alive, Hashem is not miyach and shmai on him, because he may yet do Avicha. But here we're not saying that any time before that, it said a K David. But still, the fact that it says Hashem imoy implies, therefore, that should protect him from doing such an Avicha. So what does it mean when the Navi comes to him, when Nathan, a Navi, comes to him later on and says, why did you treat contemptuously the word of Hashem to do what is evil in his eyes? It means Shabikish Lasis Vlay Asa. It means that David was going to do an Avera, but he didn't actually do it. So what does that mean that he was going to do it and he didn't do it? So the Gemara is going to discuss soon the point that we know famously that Kol Yosef Mochemes based David, that anybody who would go out to war in David's army would previously give a get to his wife. So therefore, what we're saying is David intended to do this even if there was no get, but in the event there was a get, and therefore he wasn't actually over on an Avera. We actually were going to discuss soon that Rashi and Tosfos have an argument what exactly was the nature of this get. So in fact, the Pnei Yeshua says that may be one meaning of what the Gemara means over here. We're going to see soon. Rashi learns that it was a conditional get. If I don't come back alive from the battle, then the get should take effect as of now. Tosfos learns that Tosfos has problems with that Afiyavacha and says that it was an unconditional get. So therefore, Pnei Yeshua says that that could be what the Gemara means over here. That David thought that it was a conditional get, like Rashi says, and therefore he's going to have relations with her, even though he doesn't know in advance whether the condition in fact is going to take effect. Whereas in the event, Uriah actually gave her an unconditional get, like Tosfos says, and therefore there's no avera over here. So Pnei Yeshua explains that's what it can mean. Shabikish lasis loyosa. His intention was he's going to do it regardless, and in the event it turns out there was no Avera because it was actually an unconditional get.
But that's very problematic.
One second. What is it? What?
It's very problematic because we say that David was a Tzadik Gamor, and a Tzadik Gamor doesn't have a Yetzer Hara. He doesn't even think.
Okay, and in fact, you have Gemaras in other places that mention that, in fact, David was not Roy. It's completely unexpected that David should do such a thing, even if we say there was no technical Aveira involved. And we know from the Gemara in Sanhedrin that David actually asked Hashem to test him, and Hashem told him, I'm going to be testing you in this kind of thing involving Arias. And actually, the Gemara goes so far as to say over there that David, in the end, says, that looking back on it, David says, I would have had the, Hashem tells him, David asks Hashem to test him. Hashem says, you're not going to pass the test. David says, try me anyway. I want to be on the level of the others. And so David actually says over there in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that really, I would have actually been able to hold myself back and not do it. But I didn't want people to think that, look at this, David knows more than Hashem. Hashem said he's not going to pass, and in the end I showed that I could. Elsewhere, the Gemara also says that the Gemara mentions that this with David, the Jewish people with the eagle, are examples of where these are not people who you would normally expect on the level that they were at, that they would do any such asedus, but Hashem orchestrated and made that should happen in order to teach the power of tshuva. And we know, in fact, David spent the rest of his life doing tshuva for it, even though, as we're saying in the Gemara over here, there's nothing technically wrong with what he did.
So, is he considered the tzaddik gamur or not?
He did tremendous tshuva of this afterwards, so he's still considered a tzaddik. So is he considered a tzaddik gamur? I don't know. He's considered a tzaddik. We say he's an example of a tzaddik, the libi chol al b'kibi, as the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, that he killed his Yetzer Hara with fasting. A tzaddik gamur, I don't know, but he's definitely a tzaddik. He thought to do something wrong. He didn't actually do it, because in the end, there was nothing wrong, la locha, in what he did, as we're going to discuss. But and still, he did shuv on it for the rest of his life. All right, let's go on. A different explanation, by the way, of what it means, shuvikish lachis. The also is, you find in the psukim afterwards, that David, that once he finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant, and he calls Uriah back from the battle, one of the things he wants is that Uriah should go back home and have relations with his wife. So what's going to happen, therefore? It means that therefore people are going to think, therefore, that the child is actually Uriah. David's reason for that was in order to avoid a chilul Hashem, but it does create the potential problem that people are going to mistakenly think that it's Uriah's child rather than David's, and that has all kinds of implications in halacha. So therefore, that's the shavikish lachis. Well, also, he intended to do that, but in the end, he didn't, because in the end, Uriah refused to do it, and therefore there was no way of thinking that this child was Uriah's. Okay, continues the Gemara. Omer Rab, Rebbe de Osi mi David. So Rab says, you should know, Rebbe, who is descended from David HaMelech, because in the Nesiim, beginning from Hillel, are descendants of David, Mahatech v'darish b'schosidi David. He's looking around, he's working hard to darshan that pasuk in the schos of David. So he understands the pasuk like this. When the pasuk says, Madua bazisa as dvar Hashem lase tara, when the Nabi tells him, why did you treat contemptuously the word of Hashem to do evil, the Rebbe and the Meshuna razu mikol roi shabbat Torah. This way, when it describes it, la sefara is different than the kind of description that it ever mentions anywhere else in Tanakh about somebody who did evil. Shekol rois shabbat Torah kiddu vayas. In general, when the Torah wants to say, when it wants to say that somebody did averus, it says vayas sefara, he did evil. The concept la sefara, where over here it says to do. Again, implying, as we said before, Shadikish Lathis Floy Asa, that he was going to do an Aveda, but he didn't actually do it. Now, Marshall points out, you do have other places where it says Lathis Hara about people, for example, Ahab. But, and Menashe, but there it actually says by them also Vayas Hara. So over here, it never says by David the word Vayas Hara, only Lathis Hara, and therefore Lathis Hara, and therefore we can understand that it means that David did not, unlike them, did not actually do this Aveda, he just intended to. Okay, the pasuk continues. The pasuk continues when it says, Mazua Bazisa is Bar Hashem. The pasuk continues, Eis Uriah Chiti Kisa Bacherev. The pasuk continues that the Navi accuses David, you killed Uriah Chiti with the sword. What does that mean, you killed him? It means, Shahoyalachol Adunim, the Sanhedrin Valdanta. means you should have had the Sanhedrin judge him to see whether he's a murderer of a malchus. Now, we're going to say soon, the reason why David felt free to have Uriah killed, to have him put in the thick of the battle in a place where he's unprotected and get him killed, is because he was murdered by malchus. He rebelled against David, as the Gemara is going to show, as the Gemara is going to discuss soon. But nevertheless, the Navi is telling him, still, you should have judged him, but you should have had the Sanhedrin judge him. Now, Tosfos explains, when it comes to a murder by malchus, you don't need the Sanhedrin. We learn in other places that you don't need the Sanhedrin to judge him. However, Tosfos says there's a difference. You have to have the Sanhedrin judge to decide, is what this person did considered being murdered by malchus? You have to have them ascertain the fact, is what he did such and such, does that amount to being murdered by malchus? Once that's ascertained, once they decide, yes, he's a murdered by malchus, then at that point, then the Sanhedrin is out of the picture, and then the king can have the guy executed on the spot. So the Navi is telling David, that's what you should have done. You should have, that's what you should have done. You should have had the Sanhedrin figure out first whether he's a murderer by malchus, and only then deal with it. Why indeed didn't David do that? Marsha says, because according to Rashi, that it has to be a get al tnai if he dies in battle. Then if he doesn't die in battle, then the get is not batal, and then the whole thing is undone. According to Tosfos, that it was an unconditional get. He didn't want more people to know about what's going on over here. If he has Sanhedrin judge Uriah, then people are going to start putting two and two together and say that, you know what, he had Uriah judged by the Sanhedrin and killed in order to take his wife, and David wanted to avoid that. But nevertheless, the Navi is telling him you misjudged in that. You should have had the Sanhedrin get involved rather than taking it into your own hands and deciding on your own that he's a murdered malchus. Then the pasuk continues that Ishta lakachta l'cholat Yisha, his wife you took for yourself as a wife. Now the fact that the Navi uses the expression lakachta means l'kuchin yesh l'chaba, means it is a valid marriage, meaning it's not considered that the Kedushin are choices because she's not an Eshet Ish. And why not? The Amr of Shmuel Barachmeni, Amr of Yenison, Kola Yosin and Mochemes Beis David, Kosev Get Krisus Yishai, when a person goes out to the wars of David's family, he would give his wife ahead of time a Get Krisus. So this way, if he dies or goes missing in battle, then she should be divorced and she doesn't remain in Aguna. As we find earlier, a generation earlier that Yishai, David's father, had his sons do the same thing. So in other words, David, when he became king, took over that idea and applied it to his whole army. Shenema, you find earlier when you have the story of Goliath, of the war of the battle with Goliath, that Yishai one day tells David to take some food and other stuff to his brothers who are at the war, and the prophet says, these 10 cheeses you should take to the captain of the thousands, meaning you have the army was divided into units of 10, 50, and 100, and whatever, like you find by Yitzhak and Moshe. So you have the one in charge of 1,000. So Yishai tells David to bring some food to the brothers, to his brothers, and also to bring these 10 things, these 10 wheels of cheese to the captain in charge of 1,000. That's a chech of tifkei b'shalom. Your brothers, you should check on their welfare, see how they're doing. And the pasuk continues, v'es arubosam tikach, and take their arubosam. So my arubosam, what is arubosam? Tanurin of Yosef, zvorim amur rovim bein alabena, the things that are combined between him and her, meaning the kiddushin. So in effect, Yishai is telling David, while you're there, undo their kiddushin. Meaning these boys, these older brothers of David, were already married. So when you're there, take a get from each one of them to undo the kiddushin between themselves and their wives. So that way, so we see, in other words, that there was this concept in David's family of giving a get before you go off to war, and David took that idea over when he became king. So therefore, so Uriah had given a get to Bathsheba, and therefore she's now not an Eshet Ish. Now again, here you have Rashi learns that it was a get al tnai. If I don't come back alive from the battle, then the get should take effect. Then the get should take effect as of now. However, Tosfos has a problem with that because you have actually opinions in the Gemara that say that during that time, when the get is pending, she's still considered an Eishes Ish. So how does that help? If David had relations with her during that time, she's still an Eishes Ish. What good does it do? That it takes effect afterwards. So that it takes effect eventually. So therefore, Tosfos says that no, it was an unconditional get. It was an unconditional get. So, and however, Tosfos says, even though it was unconditional, they would still keep it a secret. They would give the gift in secret because they don't want that everybody's going to, they don't want that, oh, this guy's away, let me go give kedushin to his wife and marry her. So therefore they would keep it secret. So it wasn't supposed to be that David should take advantage of it and say to go to and have relations with Bathsheba and marry her. But nevertheless, the Navi is telling him the fact of the matter is, as a matter of strict halacha, it is mutter. The people may think she's an Eishes Ish because they don't know that he gave a get, but in fact she actually did. Then the pasuk continues.
But wasn't Bathsheba supposed to sit Shiva for the death of her husband?
So it's interesting that afterwards, when the pasuk says that Bathsheba found out that Uriah had died, the pasuk has a very interesting expression about it. The expression in the pasuk is Bathishma Eishes Uriah Kineis Uriah Isha. The wife of Uriah heard that her husband Uriah had died, and she mourned for her husband. Now, the pasuk uses two different words there, Isha and Bala. So actually, the Malbim on the pasuk says, the word Ish represents the affectionate relationship between the husband and wife, and the word Baal represents the legal relationship between them. So when the pasuk says, the pasuk phrases it very carefully, she heard that her Ish Uriah died, meaning she still had affectionate feelings for him, because after all, he had been her husband, and they expected to get remarried after he came back. So she was sad for that, but in fact, that Tisbeth, Albaila, she actually, when she mourned, it was only for the fact that he was, that legally he had previously been her husband, because in fact he had been.
What's the halacha? Can a woman get remarried immediately after her husband passed away or not?
So there is a concept where you have to wait 90 days in order to make sure that if she's pregnant, then you know whose child it is. So one, I think there's a discussion someplace else. I think maybe Tosfos brings up the possibility that maybe that takana didn't exist yet in David HaMelech's time. With that said, I mean, it's also possible that Uriah had been away for quite some time in the battle like that, but 90 days might have already been passed. There is, in fact, actually, in the Zohar, it gives a timeline of when each of these things happen. I don't remember exactly because I didn't think of it beforehand to look up, but I seem to remember that the Zohar gives a timeline according to which more time had passed since Uriah had left for the battle. I'm not sure about that though.
But then we say that she was actually pregnant, right?
She became pregnant from David.
Right. So then there's no suffix over here that
that's exactly why David wanted to bring Uriah back home and have him have relations with and have him back home. And that way, if he has relations with Bathsheba, or even if he doesn't, it's not like anybody knows whether he did or not. But once they know that Uriah is back home, then already people are going to think that the child is Uriah's rather than David.
That's also mixing up, you know,
that's what we were saying before. That's one way of understanding what we mean when we say that David intended to do wrong and didn't. He intended to have the child passed off as Uriah's, which would cause problems. But in the event, Uriah didn't listen to him and didn't go back home, and therefore nothing ever happened with that anyway.
He didn't go back home because he was caught from war, or because he...
He used the excuse that, you know, all the Jewish people are intense and fighting against Bnei Ammon, and you want me to go home and be comfortable and so forth. And the Gemara is going to quote the pasuk in a couple of lines, but he used an excuse. I mean, I think you have some. Maybe some of the Mephoshim say that he got wind of what's going on and he didn't want to get involved. But whatever it is, the point is, as the Gemara is going to say soon, he disobeyed an order of David, which is a pretty serious thing. But whatever the reason is, you didn't end up going back home. So therefore, the cover-up didn't work. Yeah.
He could have been afraid that David would kill him if he came home. I mean,
no, it's the opposite. David is telling him to come home.
Yes, but he's telling him to come home, but Uriah could have thought, you know, he wants to kill me to grab the
Bathsheba. What happened?
David was a tzaddik. David was killing him for no reason.
One
tzaddik.
One second. Uriah had been away at the war for some time. David, after this whole thing, after he finds out that Bathsheba is pregnant, then he sends a message to the battlefield that Uriah should come home. And so Uriah does. Once he comes back to Yerushalayim and David asks him for an update on the battle or whatever, then he tells him, go home and wash your feet and get comfortable over there. And Uriah says that I'm not going to do that, the Jewish people are out in tents, and I'm not going to go home, and I'm not going to go home and be comfortable. And the passage describes how for a couple of days, David is trying to get him to go, for a couple of days over there, David is trying to get him to go home, and he keeps on refusing. He had no reason at this point to think that David is going to kill him. Now, what it might be is he might have gotten wind of what's going on, and therefore he realizes, you know, why David wants me to go home is in order to cover up what's going on, and I don't want to get involved with that. But whatever the case, the point is that David told him to go home, and he didn't. If he had, then, like this, people would think, when the baby was born, people would think that it was Uriah's child rather than David's. Which, yeah, as we said, that could cause problems in halacha. That could cause many years later that child might want to marry a daughter of Uriah's, and it would be also. So that's what we mean. That's as we said before. That's one explanation of what we mean. Shabikish lasis v'layosa, that David intended to do an avera by mixing up the paternity of this child, but in the end he didn't because Uriah foiled that by actually not going home. Yeah, so actually here, I found the Zohar over here. So actually, yeah, the Zohar specifically says that, in fact, Uriah had been away for more than 3 months at that point. The Zohar describes that at the end of Nisan is when David announced that we need to go to war. By the time they went, they went to war over there against Ammon and destroyed Ammon. They were in Uri Sivan. So they're there, Sivan Tammuz of Elul. The 24th of Elul is when David took Bathsheba. So this is much more than 3 months after Uriah had left. And then later on, eventually, so Uriah is killed. And on Yom Kippur, Hashem forgave David. So then the Zohar then brings another possible timeline that they were gathered together. They started announcing that everybody needs to gather on Zion Adar. They gathered on the 15th of Iyar, and the 15th of Elul, he took Bathsheba. Anyway, the point is, it was much more. It was 4 months or so. According to either timeline in the Zohar, it was 4 months or so from when Uriah left until David took Bathsheba. So much more than the 3 months.
Rabbi, if David would have gotten what he wanted, that he should go back to Bathsheba, that would have been an issue, because David officially was married to her now.
David is not married to her yet at this point. He had relations with her. He didn't necessarily do it the same kiddushin. No, it's interesting. You actually have a Gemara. You actually have a Gemara in Ksubas that brings up the possibility that maybe David literally was choyte, and nevertheless she still mutter to him eventually, even though we usually say Kashem Shasur Labal, Kakasur Labal, because she was forced into it. Tosfos over here mentions the fact that the Navi says to him that the fact that the Navi uses the expression "wakachta v'chala isha" implies that there's no actual aveda involved, there's no aveda involved in the actual kiddushin and in the actual bia. But yeah, the Gemara does bring up that possibility in Ksubas that she was considered an anusa, and therefore she'd still be mutter to her husband, only if her husband was a kohen would that be an issue. But again, according to Rashi, that it was a conditional get. That's one of the problems that Tosfos has with Rashi, is that if you're saying it was a conditional get, until the condition takes effect, until Uriah actually dies in battle, then the get is not effective. So what good does it do? David was still with an ancient dish. That's why Tosfos prefers to say that it was an unconditional get. All right, let's go on. Let's go on. The pasuk continues, and nothing says to David, the oisai haragta b'cherev ne'amon, you killed him, Uriah, with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now, what's that extra? We already have Uriah in the pasuk that says you killed him with a sword. So therefore, what it means is, so the explanation is, ma cherev ne'amon i'atanena shalav, just like when a person is killed by the Ammonim, you, David, are not held responsible for that. Uya Chiti, as a Menashal, of the same way, with the fact that Uya was killed, you're not going to be punished for that. Because again, he was killed by the Goyim in battle. It's not even, we're not even going to hold you responsible that you were, that you caused it to happen by putting him in, the thick of the battle. Because, as I was going to say, he was because my time, and now why not? Why is David not punishable for the fact that Uriah was placed in a position that he was going to be killed? Because murdered the Malchus Abba. The reason is because Uriah had rebelled against David. The Amalei, because David tells him to go home to his wife, and Uriah says, Uriah says, my master Yoav and the servants of my master in the second one, meaning the king, are camped out on the field, and you want me to go home and be comfortable. I'm not going to do that. So therefore, so Rashi says, the Merida B'Malchus is that you don't speak of somebody else as Adoni in front of the king. In front of the king, the only Adoni is the king. So it's disrespectful to the king to call somebody else Adon, especially Yoav. We actually find in a number of places throughout Shmuel Beis that David had a lot of trouble with Yoav. There were many times when Yoav was acting in a very independent way that David did not approve of. So therefore, so according to that, for Uriah to actually call him Adoni in David's presence is wrong, and that's considered mirud
imlafik. And also Rabbi.
That's also true, right? Anyway, Tosfos doesn't like that explanation. They give a different explanation from Rabbeinu Meir, who is the father of the Rashbam, and the Rivam, and Rabbeinu Tam, is that the Merid of Malchus is that just the fact that he's disobeying the king's orders. The king tells him to go home, and he's saying, I don't want to, I have this and this and this excuse. You're not supposed to be doing that. The king gives you a direct order. You do it. Okay, Marshall says that after all, we should still defend what Rashi's saying. The fact is, okay, you're fine. He's not intending to call Yoav a king, but still, why are you mentioning him with the word Adoni and in the same breath as Adoni HaMelech? And in fact, even putting him ahead of the king, first you're mentioning Adoni Yoav, then you're mentioning Adoni HaMelech. So for all those reasons, it's considered Merudim HaMalchus. Okay, so therefore, so we're saying that the David is not actually punishable for having caused Uriah's death because he had the right to have him executed as a murdered Malchus. However, as Gemara said before, he should have had the Sanhedrin decide that for him, whether in fact what Uriah did amounts to murdered Malchus.
Rabbi Alex, if he was a murdered Malchus and the king has the right to kill him, why send him to the front? Why not just kill him? By sending him to the front, doesn't it look like a subterfuge?
So in fact, that is an explanation, is that David did not want, like this, if David actually goes and executes Uriah as a Merid Malchus, a few things happen from that. One problem of that is that now it's a huge embarrassment to Uriah, that now everybody knows he was a Merid Malchus. And look, I mean, Uriah had been a very important member of David's army. Later on, near the end of Sefer Shmuel, this David Giborim, you had the elite unit of his army, and Uriah is on that list. He's the last on the list, but he's still on the list. So it would be a tremendous humiliation for Uriah if now he's being executed as a Merid Malchus. And also, it would really look really bad that people are now going to, again, start putting two and two together and figure, look at this, David wants Bathsheba, so therefore he trumped up charges against Uriah and had him executed as a Merid Malchus in order to take his wife. So again, David figured this was all part of the attempted cover-up to avoid a Chilul Hashem. David intended that Uriah should die in battle. Okay, you know what? If soldiers die in battle all the time, so that way it wouldn't look bad on Uriah. It wouldn't look bad for Uriah. It wouldn't look bad for David. Actually, you have a Medrash that says that David sent a secret message to Yoav telling him to do that, to put Uriah in a place, in a position where he's going to end up getting killed, and to keep this information secret. But the Medrash says, actually, Yoav did not keep it a secret. When the people, when the rest of the army are coming and yelling at him, how could you do such a thing? How could you be so careless with one of our best guys, Uriah, and put him in a position like that? Instead of taking the heat, Yoav took out David's letter and showed it to them. which destroyed the whole thing. So now everybody knows. So now everybody knows that Uriah was a murdered Malchus. Now everybody knows that David was involved in getting him killed, which causes, therefore, the Chil Hashem that David was trying to prevent. So in fact, the Medrash says David was very, very angry with Uriah for that, for spilling the beans like that. He should have taken the heat and then said, okay, you know, it happens. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. And then the cover-up would have been more successful, and then it wouldn't have made such a Chil Hashem. But going on, Omer Rab, if you analyze what David did throughout his life, the only thing you can find wrong is this whole story with Uriah. As we find later on, the Pasuk describes that David did everything that Hashem wanted, except for the matter of Uriah Achiti. Now, Tosfos asked the question, what about, we also have the story where David counted the Jewish people where he wasn't supposed to. So Tosfos says, okay, first of all, it wasn't such a big Aveda, relatively speaking. Also, after all, it was the Shoigig. He didn't intend to do an Aveda. He misunderstood that, as we learned in Brachas, he thought that you're allowed to count the Jewish people directly, and it was only in the time of the Mishkan that you weren't, or whatever it is. So therefore, it was the Shoigig, and therefore it's not counted. Okay, so only the matter of Uriah. So the Gemara says, Abaya Shisha Romi de Rav. So Abaya the elder pointed out a contradiction though between two statements of Rav. Mi Omer Rav Hachi. Did Rav actually say that the only thing that David ever did wrong was this whole story with Uriah? The same Rav said that there's another thing David did wrong, that he accepted Lashon Hara, as the Gemara is going to discuss soon, what Lashon Hara David listened to. That's also an Aveda. Okay, the Gemara says Kasha. You're right, we're left with a Kasha, how that Rav statement seems to contradict each other. There's an interesting Sefer called Koshes Miyushav from Rabbi Shaya Pick. Rabbi Shaya Pick was a tremendous goyin who lived about 300 years ago. In particular, we have a lot of the Masoret Hashas that we have on the side of the Gemara. A lot of the cross references in Shas come from on the side of the Gemara come from him. But he has a sefer called Koshes Miyushav, which goes through all the times when the Gemara ends off something with Kasha and tries to find the answer. He says, since the Gemara is going to say over here that as a result of this. That David was actually punished for that Lashon Hara, then therefore Rav doesn't count that. So the fact that he was punished for it takes away that now it's not considered an outstanding Aveda. On the other hand, David was punished in various ways for the story of Bathsheba, but not specifically for the matter of that he had Uriah killed without having him judged by the Sanhedrin, and therefore Rav can say that Aveda still remained outstanding and David didn't receive, and therefore you can say that he had the one Aveda. Okay.
How can you say a person's Makabal Lashon Hara? Just because he listens to it, he may have in mind, I'm not going to believe it. I just want to...
Because we're going to see in the story that we're going to discuss now that he actually accepted it and believed it. So Gufa, let's get into that story. Rav Amakibal David Lashon Hara. Where do we see that David accepted, listened to Lashon Hara? Dichtiv, like this. It starts out like this. The Pasuk describes how at one point David says, after he's securely established as king, I wonder whether there were any descendants of Yonatan left over. Yonatan, my good friend, he had a covenant, et cetera, et cetera. So I wonder if there were any descendants of his left. So the Pasuk says that he found a man named Siva, who's a slave of Shaul's family. So David asks him, so Siva says, yes, there is a son of Yonatan named Mephibosheth. So the king asks him, where is this Mephibosheth? And Vayomer Tziva al HaMelech, Tziva answers, Hinehu beis Machir ben Amiel b'loy devar. He's in the house of Machir ben Amiel in Loy devar. Now, on the simple meaning, Loy devar is the name of the city in Eber HaYarden. But the Gemara's understanding that what it means is, Loy devar also means there's no word in him. In other words, that the Tziva is falsely claiming that Mephibosheth is an Amoret. He doesn't know any Torah. And the Pasuk continues, that the king sent and had Mephibosheth brought from the house of Machir ben Amiel from Loy Devar, and the word Miloy can also be read Molay. from Mole Dover. He found him, not like Siva said, that he's Loy Dover, that he's empty of any words of Torah. Just the opposite. He's Moloy Dover, Mole Dover, he's full of words of Torah. So in other words, already at that point, Marshall learns it a little bit differently. Marshall says that Loy Dover, actually in the process, Loy Dover is spelled with a vav. So it means that Loy Dover, it means that it means that Siva spoke Lashon Hara about you. He tells Mr. Boshet, you should know that Siva spoke Lashon Hara about you. And actually, I found, and now I find, when he comes and talks to Mr. Boshet, he finds that, in fact, Mr. Boshet knows a lot. In fact, in Brachas, we learned that Mr. Boshet was even David Rebbe, although the post was discussed over there, it may have been a different Mr. Boshet. But anyway, the point is that so he already knew that this Siva is a Baal Lashon Hara. But so that's not considered accepting Lashon Hara, because like you said, as soon as he found out the facts, then he didn't accept it. But Mechti Chazir de Shakorahu, but at this point David knows that the Siva is a liar and he's trying to make Mr. Boshet look bad. He harder al Shini Levei. So now fast forward many years, when this same Siva says Lashon Hara about Mr. Boshet, my time of Kiblamine, then why did David accept it? He should have already realized that Siva is giving him fake news about Mr. Boshet. Where do we see that he accepted Lashon Hara? Bichtiv. Many years later, you have Avshalom has rebelled against David, so David and his people are escaping Yerushalayim, and then the Pasuk mentions that this same Siva came out to greet David, and he had donkeys, and he had food, and whatever, and the Pasuk says, Vayomer HaMelech el Siva v'ayeh ben adenecha. So the king says to Siva, where is the son of your master? And it looks very nice. I'm glad you came with all the stuff for me and my people, but you're Mephibosheth's servant. Where is Mephibosheth himself? And by Yom Siva Alamarachini Hu Yoshev Yerushalayim Adomer, and Siva answers that Mephibosheth stayed behind in Yerushalayim because he figures that eventually now you're going to have, pretty soon he figures the people are going to get sick of Avshalom as well, and with David and Avshalom both out of the picture, then I'll get back the kingship that was originally in my family. So that was Siva's Lashon Hara, that he claimed that Mephibosheth didn't come to join David because he's actually expecting to get back the kingship. And Umanolon de Kibomine, so where do we see that David accepted Lashon Hara, which he shouldn't have done? This did, because the project continues. By Yom HaMelech, the king said, in that case, then Siva, I'm giving you everything that belonged to Mr. Boshet. By Yom Siva, Yishtachabesi, and Siva says, I bow, I will find favor in the king's eyes. So we see that David listened to what Siva is saying and believes him that Mr. Boshet stayed behind, not that Mr. Boshet stayed behind because he wants, because he doesn't want to go with David, and because he wants, because he figures eventually he's going to get back the kingship for himself. So that's according to that. Well, Shmuel on the loy kibble David Lashon Hara. Shmuel disagrees and says that no, that's not considered Kabbalah Lashon Hara because he didn't just depend on what Siva is saying. Actually, what it is Dvarim ani korim chazavei. What it is when eventually David did see Mr. Boshet, he saw certain things on him that made him realize that what Siva is saying actually may have truth to it. That in this case, yes, Siva has a reputation previously as a Baal Lashon Hara, but that doesn't mean that everything he says is false. In this case, Shmuel saying eventually David saw certain things on Mr. Boshet that made him realize that what Siva is saying, that there's some truth to it, that in fact Mr. Boshet is disappointed that David is back. What happened? Yichdid. Eventually, after David finally makes it back, after Absalom is killed and the rebellion is over, the pasuk says, "Mephibosheth ben Shaul yorav b'snei Amelach, the Kras Amelach." Mephibosheth ben Shaul came down in front of the king to greet him on his way back. Loy osa raglov. He had not trimmed the hair on his legs or between his legs. Loy osa sama. He hadn't trimmed or made neat his mustache. That's the god of Lekibes, and he hadn't washed his clothes from when the king had left Yerushalayim until he came back home. So now, when you think of it, there's two ways of explaining what Mephibosheth did. One is that even though he couldn't go with David, as the pasuk is going to say, one thing you have to realize is that Mephibosheth, as Gemara is going to quote soon from the pasukim, Mephibosheth was lame. When he was 5 years old, the pasuk says his nurse had dropped him and he broke both of his legs. So he couldn't get around on his own. He needed other people to help. The one way of looking at this that Mephibosheth is very unkempt is that all this time he was in tremendous sorrow over the fact that David, his good friend, has had to be forced out of Yerushalayim, and therefore he couldn't go with David, and therefore as a sign of mourning, as a sign of commiserating with what David is going through, he's not cutting his hair and washing his clothes, etc. The other way of understanding it, though, is David took it to mean just the opposite, that Mephibosheth is upset over the fact that David is back. He's upset that, look, okay, now all my plans have gone up in smoke. Now I'm not going to get back to kingship because David is back and people are going to take him back as king. And therefore, once he finds out that David is on the way back, then he starts doing that. David took it the second way. And in fact, we'll see soon in the Gemara. We'll see soon in the Gemara that actually the way that Mephibosheth talked to David, as we're going to see on Amud Beis, all of that put together was reason for David to think that actually Mephibosheth is sad over the fact that David came back and is going to resume the kingship, and therefore Shmuel is saying, based on that, it's not considered that David accepted Lashon Hara, because in fact, in this case, what Siva was saying seems to have truth to it. So the pasuk continues, by he ki bo Yerushalayim l'kras ha-melech, when David was coming close to Yerushalayim, and the Mephibosheth came out to greet him, so David asked Mephibosheth, why didn't you come along with me during all these months of Golos that I was away from Yerushalayim, like all the other good friends did? And Mephibosheth answers, Adoni Amalek, my master the king, Avdi Rimoni, my slave, Siva, tricked me, Ki Omar Avdecha, because your servant, meaning I, had said, Ech v'shaliach hamor, I will saddle up the donkey, the Erkav Aleha, the Elech HaTamelech, and I'll ride on the donkey and I'll go with you. I can't go on foot, Kipiseach Avdecha, because I'm lame. And the pasuk continues, Vayirago v'Avdecha l'adon. Meanwhile, Mephibosheth said, what happened was Siva took the donkey and left on his own, so now I didn't have anything. Vayirago v'Avdecha l'adon yamelech. He went and said Lashon Hara about your servant, about me, to my master, the king. Meanwhile, you are like a malach of Hashem, so you do whatever you see fit. And the pasuk continues, David says to Mephibosheth, Lomas Daber Oy Dvarach, why are you keeping talking? I got your point, but I'm maybe not. Maybe you're saying the truth that you wanted to come with me, maybe not. You know what? My decision is that you and Siva should divide up the field. In other words, before I was going to say that Siva should get all of it, but now, fine. So now I have a suffix on it. Fine. For mom and I'm also a suffix choking. So now I'm not sure which one of you is telling the truth. So fine. Then you get half of it, and I'm going to give Siva half of it. And then Mephibosheth answers the king, Gam if I kill you, let him already take the whole thing. Because the king has returned home safely. Now, what does that mean? It means Mephibosheth is saying it in a complaining tone of voice. He's saying, all this time I was looking forward to when you're going to return home in peace. And you're doing such a thing that you're believing or half believing Lashon Hara about me. You know what? My complaint is not so much against you. My complaint is more against Hashem that he brought you home safely. That I would have been better. I would have been better off after all if you didn't. So in other words, the point is my Rosh is saying, why does he need to mention the fact that the king came home safely? If he just means, fine, I accept the king's judgment, he would just say, Gamas HaKoyikah. So therefore he's saying that you know what, I'm actually not so happy because the king came home, therefore I have no choice, I have to listen. But you know what, I would have rather that you didn't. So we see therefore Shmuel says that, okay, to begin with, when Siva said, now obviously at that point, when Siva had to begin with said that Mephibosheth stayed back home because he didn't want to come with you, then fine, David is saying, when David is accepting that, Ranab is saying that Kibol David, Lashon Hara, so Shmuel is saying, okay, fine, but at that point, he didn't actually do anything yet. He said, when he said, Kol Asher, Mephibosheth, everything that belongs to Mephibosheth is going to go to you, he doesn't mean that right now I'm doing that. He means, you know what, if that turns out to be true, then okay, then I'm giving everything that Mephibosheth belongs to you because he's a Mergamah. Now in the end, David says that you get half of it. So therefore, the Rav is saying it still amounts to accepting Lashon Hara. Again, he should have realized that Siva is not is a fake news guy. He's telling he's a Baal Lashon Hara. He's not looking out for Mephibosheth is good. So it's more likely that Mephibosheth, the fact that he didn't trim his mustache and so on and so forth, is because of a sow that David was in Golos, and therefore that David should realize at that point that Siva made up the whole story, and that Mephibosheth is loyal to him, and instead he didn't, and therefore Rav holds David guilty for doing that. Whereas Shmuel is saying that, no, David had a right to think because of the way that Mephibosheth looked so unkempt, and because of the way he phrased himself at the end, which amounts to saying, you know what, I would have rather you didn't come back home, then therefore Shmuel is saying that's not considered Kabbalah Flush and Hora to accept that, because there's definitely reason to think that Mephibosheth is not completely loyal to him. So the pasuk continues, Heiner Dichtiv, this that we said, that Mephibosheth is complaining about that Hashem brought David home safely, this explains, the Heiner Dichtiv, Ben Yon Honathan Meriv Boal. This explains, in Divrei Yomim, it mentions, it meant this same son of Yehonathan is called Meriv Baal. So what do you mean? He Meriv Baal Shmai. His name wasn't Meriv Baal. Baal and Mephibosheth Shmai. His name is Mephibosheth. Because he had an argument with his master, with Hashem, because like this, he's saying, my complaint is to Hashem that he brought you, David, home safely, therefore he's called Meriv Baal. And in fact, Yotza Basko, Nosa Bar Nosa, a Basko came out and said to Mephibosheth, you're speaking wrongly. You're an arguer, the son of an arguer. Not the Hodamor, and we just said he himself is an arguer against Hashem, that he's saying, I'm sorry that Hashem brought you home, I would have rather that he didn't. And Bar Nasa, where do we see that Shaul was the same thing? In the battle against Amalek, the Pasuk says that Shaul came to the city of Amalek and fought in the valley. So what does that mean, he fought in the valley? Amar Avnani al Iske Nahal. It means he was fighting and arguing over the matter involving the valley. We know that there's a mitzvah of Egla Arufa. You find a dead body, then you have to bring an Egla Arufa. So Shaul is saying to himself, as Gemara quotes elsewhere, now look at this, Hashem treats the loss of even one life so seriously that you have to do a whole Egla Arufa. Haytochen, that way I should be destroying so many lives from Amalek. So he's arguing with Hashem and saying, so to speak, I know better than Hashem. So the Baskel is saying to Mephibosheth, you're doing the same kind of thing as your grandfather, Shaul, you're also arguing against and second-guessing Hashem for bringing David home safe. In fact, by the way, on Omar Aleph, we quoted a pasuk that calls Mephibosheth the son of Shaul, Mephibosheth ben Shaul. So in fact, that's why here the Ion Yaakov and Ein Yaakov says that that's actually why the prophet called him Ben Shaul, even though his grandfather was Shaul, because of this, because of the similarity between him and Shaul in this, that they're both arguing against and second guessing Hashem. Amr of Yehuda Amarab, the Shah Shah Amr David and Mr. Boshes after the Siva Tasak with Asada, when David says this to Mr. Boshes, you and Siva will divide up the field, because again, David is saying, I'm not sure which one of you to believe, therefore I'm going to do it. Like, moment, I'm looking for Suffolk, I'm going to divide it. When he said that, Yosta Basko Amr Loya, Basko came out and said to David, by the same token, ask Rechavim and Yerovam Yachlok with Amalofa. The same way, Rechavim and Yerovam, two generations later, are going to divide up the kingship. And you actually have a great similarity between that, because Yerovam was a subject of Rechavim, and by rights, he shouldn't have had a kingdom of his own. So the same way, as David believed the Lashon Hara of the slave of Siva against the master, Mephibosheth, the same way, Hashem divided up the kingdom between Rechavim and his servant Yerovam. Amr of Yehuda Amr Rav, so in that connection, Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Ilmole Lekibol David Lashon Hara, if David had not accepted that Lashon Hara against Mephibosheth, Loi Nechlecha Malchus Beis David, the kingdom of Beis David never would have been split up in the first place, Voi Ovdu Yisrael Avodah Zarah, the result is the Jewish people never would have started worshipping Avodah Zarah, because they only started that when Yerovam set up his Eglei HaZahav, and therefore v'lo galdunu me'aseinu. And the result is we never would have gone into galus because the galus all eventually came as a result of Avodah Zarah and other avodas that the Jewish people were doing. So it all goes back to David accepting this lashon hara against Mephibosheth. And by the way, the Maharal points out, we know in general that in David's times there were serious problems with Lashon Hara. I think we mentioned it before, that in David's times, you know that for the most part they were tzaddikim, there were many Bali Lashon Hara among them, and therefore a lot of people were killed in their battles. So we see the Maharal says there was a Yetzahara of Lashon Hara going around at the time, and according to Rav, David was affected by that also. I guess we'll stop over here and we'll finish up the Agad to tomorrow and start the new Perek.
What time do you want to share with the Shabbat?
Ah, right. Maybe we should continue now that you mention it, but tomorrow is Matzah Shabbos. As it is, we're going to be learning quite late, because Shabbos doesn't even end until after 8:30. That's a very good point. Shabbos ends, like, 8:30 or something, so I guess we're going to have to call
8:30.
It
ends at 8:38.
Yeah, so in that case, we're going to have to call, I guess we'll call the shiur for 9:45 then.
Right.
Yeah. So maybe actually, if you guys have time, maybe we should continue on a bit more now, because otherwise, as it is, on Shabbos, we're going to go quite late.
Why we have to make this here at 9:45 if Shabbos is finished at 8:38? What's the
time?
Because he's a family person. He's got children. He's got to clean up.
You don't need an hour to make Abdallah. Sorry.
No, you don't. But maybe you don't need an hour of Moshe, but I do.
He's got a family. He's got to clean up. His responsibilities. We have to share him.
Okay.
Rabbi says he's a time person.
Be that as it may. Do we have a few more minutes to continue now, or should we just
sure.
Take up the Moshe family?
Yeah. Yes, of course. You continue. I have to go. Thank you.
Okay, fine. All right. The next one on our list, where we're saying that he didn't really do the Avera that the Pasuk makes it sound like he did, is Shloimeh. Now you have in the Pasuk in there. Now we know that Shloimeh married many Goyish wives. So this that he married them itself was something wrong, although the Rambam stresses he was Megayer them, so it's not like he was over on the Avera of marrying Goyish women, which is a pretty serious Avera, but we're not focusing on that. We're focusing on the passage makes it sound like David built altars for Avodah Zarah for them and actually worshipped Avodah Zarah. So if you think that Shloimeh himself actually worshipped Avodah Zarah and built altars for them, then you're making a mistake. Because the passage says, it says his heart was not perfect with Hashem like the heart of his father David, implying so he wasn't on the caliber of his father of his father David's heart, but he didn't actually do Aveda either. He didn't actually not at least not an Aveda of that thing, like worshiping of his other. So what does it mean when the Pasuk says that when Shloimeh got old, his wives turned his heart away and towards Avodah Zarah? It means how he could have nothing. That means like what Rav Nosson says. You have nothing, Rami, because Rav Nosson pointed out a contradiction. Let's look. Again, the Pasuk says that when Shloimeh got old, his wives turned away his heart, which makes it sound like he actually worshipped Avodah Zarah. Boksiv to Levav David Ovid, but on the other hand, the Pasuk says that his heart wasn't complete with Hashem like the heart of his father David, Kilavav David Ovid like have a mixed namile chata, and that part of the Pasuk implies that he wasn't like David, but he didn't actually worship Avodah Zarah either. If he had actually worshipped Avodah Zarah, then he wouldn't even begin to contrast him with David. The contrast implies he wasn't as good as David, but he wasn't so terrible either. So what does that mean? Ha'hikama means it means that when he was old, his wives were trying to have an influence on him to get him to be involved in Avodah Zarah, that he should go after other gods, but not that he actually went after them. So So they tried to convince him, but he didn't actually. So that itself is held against him. The very idea, imagine, you know, you would go, for example, imagine, you know, picture somebody going to the Rebbe and trying to get him involved in Avodah Zarah, Chas V'Shalom, you know, completely beyond the very idea that anybody would even have the chutzpah to do that shows, in other words, that Shlomo wasn't where he should be, because if he had been where he should be, then they wouldn't have even had a half hour minutes try to convince him. So the fact that they even tried to convince him is held against Shlomo, because it means, in other words, that obviously they had reason to think that he might be susceptible to what they're saying. So the question is, the pasuk says, then Shlomo will build a bama for Chmoyav, a bama mizbeach for Chmoyav, the idol of Moyav. So that means he built a bama, he built an altar for Avodah Zarah. The answer is Shabikish Livnes Lebana. Oz Yivna Shlomo means he intended to build it, he didn't actually build it. Because otherwise he would have said, Oz Bona Shlomo. So the question is, Elamei Asa, by that logic, if you're going to tell me that Yivna always means that he intended to do something but didn't actually do it, what about Oz Yivna Yeshua Mizbeach Hashem? What about a pasuk that says that then will Yeshua build a Mizbeach Hashem on Har Abel? Are you going to say the same thing? Are you going to say it means he intended to build it and he didn't? Ela Bibona. There, obviously, it means he actually built it. So it means he intended to, he had in mind he's going to build it, and he actually built it. So therefore, we should say the same thing by Shlomo, that if it says Oz Yivna, it means he intended to build it and he actually built it. Ela Bibona, there it means he built it. Hochanami Bibona. Shouldn't it mean the same thing over here, that Shlomo actually built the altar? And if he did, it means he was actually involved in Avodah Zarah. Ela Kedetanya. No, we have to learn it like this, like the way we learn in a Brisa. Rabbi Yossi points to a pasuk much later, towards the end of Sefer Melachim. It describes over there how Yeshayahu went systematically throughout Eretz Yisrael and got rid of all the Avodah Zarah that he could find. And the pasuk describes that the bamos asher apnei Yerushalayim, the bamos that were in front of Yerushalayim, Hashem yimin lahara mishcha, that are to the right, meaning to the south side of hara mishcha, actually the pasuk is hara mashvis, which literally means the destroying, literally means the destroying, the destroying man. Hara mishcha is another name for hara zeitun. The pasuk actually calls it hara mashvis, because we know in general anything that has to do with Avodah Zarah, you're supposed to call it by derogatory name. So anyway, so the bombers that were there, Asher Bona Shlomo Melech Yisrael Ashtoreth Shikot Tzedonim, remember, which Shlomo Melech Yisrael had built for Ashtoreth, the disgusting Avodah Zarah of the Tzedonim, etc. So Yeshayahu destroyed them. So what do you mean that there were still bombers there from Shlomo's time hundreds of years earlier? Are you going to tell me that Asa and Yehoshaphat, that these bombers existed in Asa and Yehoshaphat's time and they didn't destroy them? And then they had to wait 200, 300 years for Yeshayahu to come and destroy them. We know that Asa and Yehoshaphat destroyed all the Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael long before Yeshayahu. So how are these bombers still there hundreds of years later? So therefore, the Braise is saying, Rav Yossi is saying, that what it means is, the Pasuk, by phrasing it that way, wants to tell us a comparison between the earlier generations and the later generations. The earlier ones, meaning Shlomo, and the later generations, meaning Yeshayahu. Ma achronim loy osu, just like Yeshayahu did not, in fact, destroy everything that we're saying over here, because some of these things, these bombers, were destroyed long before his time, by Osu and Yeshayahu, and yet, and yet the Pasuk considers it in his favor and writes as though Yeshayahu destroyed them, because had they been around in his time, he would have destroyed them. He destroyed everything that still existed in his time. So the fact that Asa and Yehoshaphat preempted him and destroyed them, it's not his problem, right? He's still credited with destroying them, because if they had still been around in his time, he would have. After Shonim, well, also the same way, the earlier generations, meaning Shlomo himself, did not actually make it the Tola Behem Lignai, but the Pasuk considers him guilty as if he did. So that's what it means. In other words, so the Pasuk is not saying that Shlomo actually built them, just like it's not saying that Yeshayahu actually destroyed them. In both cases, it's saying that he would have if he could have. So Shlomo would have built these Mizbechas if he could have, but in the end he didn't. And the same way, Yeshayahu would have destroyed them if he could have, but he didn't, because they were already destroyed before. the Tnei Yeshua has a different understanding of it. He says that what it means is that Shlomo's wives actually did start building these bomos, but Shlomo prevented them from finishing it, so they never actually became bomos. That is why Asa and Yehoshaphat didn't destroy them. Yoshiyahu eventually destroyed those partially built bomos that had been sitting there for hundreds of years. So we're saying that the Asa and Yehoshaphat didn't destroy them because they weren't actual bomos. Yeshiyahu did, even though they were only partial bombers, but all Shlomo had done was, in his time, they became partial bombers, and he stopped them at that point. So the question is, after all, the prophet says Shlomo did what was evil in Hashem's eyes, implying that he actually did. And the answer is, Ella, Mipnesha, Hoyle, Limchis, Benoshav, again, as we said before, because he could have protested against his wives and prevented them from doing this. And he didn't. Therefore, the prophet considers it as if he did the Aveira.
Didn't we just say that Shlomo did stop them from doing the finishing?
So according to Pnei Yeshua, he stopped them from finishing these mizbeches. But nevertheless, even the Pnei Yeshua apparently would say that, okay, but nevertheless, in general, in the other things that they were doing for Avodah Zarah, he didn't stop them. Like this, for example, maybe they're worshipping Avodah Zarah in their private apartments or whatever, and he didn't prevent them from doing that. Here, where it's a big public thing, then yeah, he stopped them from building these mizbeches. But in other words, he could have done much more in order to prevent them from worshipping the Avodah Zarah, and therefore he's blamed for it. Amar of Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Noach Loilo Oseh Tzadik Sheyeh Shamash L'Damar Acher. That Tzadik Shlomo would have rather that he would end up being a servant of Davar Acher, meaning of Avodah Zarah, that he'd end up being he'd have to be, for example, a wood chopper or a water drawer or whatever for the sake of a temple of Avodah Zarah. Vayukosu by Vayasa Rabbe Ein Hashem, rather than that should have been written on him in the pasuk Vayasa Rabbe Ein Hashem. Shlomo would have done, if he had known that it was going to be written in the pasuk like that about him, he would have done anything to prevent it, even taken the most menial job. And in fact, you have a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says, when the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were drawing up a list of which kings lost their place in El Haba, they were going to add Shlomo to it, and they were finally told by Min HaShemayim that that's wrong to do. But nevertheless, there's real reason to think that Shlomo did something seriously wrong over here. So Or Gemara is saying that after all, it was only that he wasn't Moshe. But nevertheless, we see the fact that it says Vayasara, and the fact that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah thought that he doesn't have a place in Gan Eden, it shows that it was still considered pretty serious. So in this connection, Amar of Yehuda Amar Shmuel, to give you an idea what Shlomo's wives were doing bad. The Shah should not the Shlomo as Bas Pare. When Shlomo married the daughter of Pare, she brought in 1,000 kinds of musical instruments for the wedding. And she actually told him, this is played in front of this Avodah Zarah, that's played in front of that Avodah Zarah. And he didn't protest against her, and he didn't say, in that case, if it's done in front of Avodah Zarah, then I don't want it at our wedding. So we see that already then he wasn't being Moshe when they were doing things of Avodah Zarah. And Omer of Yehuda Amar Shmuel, b'shosh and not the Shlomo as Bas Parai, when Shlomo married this Bas Parai, Yorad Gabriel v'noach Konar b'yam, Gabriel came down and stuck a stick into the ocean, into the sea, but all of those Sirta, and eventually over time, dirt and rocks and mud and whatever collected around the stick, but all of Nivna, Krach Gadol Sharoimi, and eventually the great city of Rome was built on that place. So in other words, the point is that that Shlomo married Bas Parai, that was the beginning of the process that eventually led to the Churban, that eventually led to Rome becoming big and powerful and eventually destroying the Beit Hamikdash. The Masnif Tana, in a brighter, we learn a further stage, on the day when Yerovam set up with 2 Eglei Zahav, which is 30 odd years later, Echad Beveitov, Echad Bedan, Nivnet Srich Echad, at that point, at the same time, in Italy, one hut was built on that ground, on that rocks and whatever that had gathered around the sticks in the time of the Shlomo. The Zeu Italia Shoyob, and this became the beginning of Greek Italy, which is, Rashi explains that Italia is the name of the city, on the face of it, Italia is the name of the country, but whatever, the point is that became the beginning of the city of Rome, was with that one hut that they built, and eventually it developed into the big city of Rome. So we see, in other words, that as things deteriorate, Beruchnius among the Jewish people, then Hashem makes the Goyim more and more powerful. In fact, the Yerushalmi adds another one on the day that Eliyahu was taking up the Shemayim is the day when the Romans got their first king. as things are, as the Jewish people are not behaving as they're supposed to, and Shlomo is marrying Bas Paris, which, okay, he meant it L'Shem Shemayim, all of them he meant L'Shem Shemayim, in order to have a good influence on their countries. But we see the other way around. The influence went the other way. They're influencing towards Avodah Zarah, even if he didn't actually worship it. So therefore, so in the end, it became that from that comes the strength of the Goyim. Okay, so we only have a little bit left. So I think we'll leave that and the beginning of the new parak for Matzah Shabbos, Shem.
Yes,
Shem.
Yeah, a wonderful Shabbos.
Thanks, Shem.
Shabbos.